Good evening. I'm going to call the meeting to order for this evening, and just a couple of things. I'm not on WebEx because we're still in the car, and I think that I have a better shot of maintaining cell coverage than trying to use the browser on my phone. So, a couple things, like we talked about last week, not talking over each other tonight is going to be important so that we can capture this. And if we could do the roll call here in just a second by just having people introduce themselves that are on the task force and staff and in the audience, we'll capture that that way. Kim contacted me late this afternoon and said she might have a conflict. She'll be here if she can. Can you guys hear me? Does this sound right?
Sounds good. Sounds
good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Very good. So, and then the other thing is, because I can't see you, I asked Mr. Coffin today if he would see my eyes and help me hear. We're going to have a presentation tonight by Mr. Winter. I know that there are questions and that there will be a good discussion this evening. If you could please work with Greg, with Mr. Coffin, on yielding the floor to each other and being careful that we all get a chance to talk. So if we could start with the roll call, if you could just say your name.
Sure. Jan Hedrick.
Cody Darr.
Pam Burris.
Bill Whitehammer.
Tony Grove.
Old John's back.
Rick Colvin.
Katrina Bowles.
Jim Windsor.
John Clark.
John, you want to?
John Glasscock.
Ted Johnson.
Hi. Maria Oropala.
Chris Kinner. Yeah, I didn't catch the last couple names after John Clark.
John Glasscock and Tad is here, and then...
Okay, very good. Thank you.
There's two other visitors.
Okay. So we need to start with the approval of the agenda. If folks have had a chance to review it, let's discuss any changes or updates and then move to approve.
Find that spot where I was referred
to. Agenda, not the...
Oh, on the agenda. Okay, never mind.
I'll make a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Okay. And then we have the draft of the minutes from the August 24th meeting. If there are... changes, additions, corrections. Let's discuss those and then decide what to do with these for the night.
On the first page, under approval of minutes, it says Kim Krause approved the August 9th meeting. I think it should say that she made a motion to approve it.
Okay.
And then I saw that on page 2, the fourth line, it says Ms. Coffin instead of Mr. Coffin, assuming he wants that changed.
I think we had discussed putting a note on here about referencing the recordings for a more complete.
Mm-hmm.
I would just recommend that note be added.
To the end.
Sure.
Yeah. So for the person taking minutes, that should just be a simple sentence that says the full recording of the meeting is located on our Project Task Force's Google website. All right. Any other changes to the minutes from the 24th? Okay, can I get a motion for approval, please?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, in favor?
Aye.
Abstain.
Great. Okay. And so our first item of business tonight is the presentation by Mr. Windsor. And Jim, if you could make sure that when you start to talk that I can, I hope to be able to hear you. And also, this is primarily what we have on the agenda for this evening. We do need to talk about a public hearing scheduling conflict for later in the fall. But Mr. Windsor, is it okay if people ask questions as you move through your presentation in brief, and then we'll have a question and answer period at the end?
Sure. Tracy, real quick, we had another visitor arrive. Could you introduce yourself?
Michael McMahon.
Did you hear that?
No.
Michael McMahon.
Okay, thank you.
So would you like me to go ahead and start?
Yes, please.
Okay. My name is Jim Windsor. I'm the Assistant Director of Columbia Utilities. The utilities are structured into, there's five utilities. There is operational, there's two assistant directors for operations, one over water and electric and one over sewer, solid waste, and stormwater. And then I am over the financial side with the utility billing and energy efficiency areas, but all of the financial sides of the utilities. What I'm going to do is kind of run through some, I think I've only got about 10 slides to kind of give you a high-level overview of the financial planning practices of the water and electric utilities in particular. I've been working for the city for over 34 years. I worked in the rates and fiscal planning side for 30 of those years with rate design, cost of service analysis, forecasting, multiple financial planning areas. And for the last 16 years, I've been in charge of that division. So the city of Columbia operates under GASB, the Government Accounting Standards Board. However, the water and electric utilities are required to do filings to the federal government, and we have to have a different set of accounting. And the two areas are, for water is a National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, and the electric side is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And this is based on the size of our utilities. Once you get to a certain size, we have to report to the federal government, and we have been doing this since I've been working for the city, so we've been at that size for a long time. While our accounts are budgeted under GASB, we collect information based on an operational type of accounting. So they allow us to break down cost into functional categories: production, distribution, transmission, customer related, so that we can do cost of service analysis. Now, what a cost of service analysis does is you collect all of this information, all the cost, and hopefully everybody is charging to these right areas. So that you can allocate those costs to these different categories, and then even under that, you allocate them a little farther. For instance, in electricity, you do demand and energy. On water side, you can do fire flow, so that you get more specific on where the costs are. On the GASB side, you're looking at personnel and supplies and contracts and things like that. On the FERC side or the NARUC side, where is those personnel hours spent? What are they doing? They're working in production, they're working in distribution area, they're working in customer service. What is this? What are those dollars used for? So that's the distinction. And in the cost of service analysis, we break the customer classes, residential, small commercial, large commercial, on electric, and industrial, and allocate the revenue and the cost associated with that, and determine if each of those customer classes are paying their way, basically. So it's a cost causation analysis. And then, so the results are used in rate making. Now, there are other considerations in rate making, such as here we have inverted block structure, which is a conservation-oriented rate structure. As you use more, you pay more. There are other considerations. Some utilities will have special rates to bring industries in. They'll have a economic development rate. We do not have that here, but that is a possible option that can be done. And there's other considerations when you actually get to the rate design.
Jim?
Yeah.
Another way on the rates there, it's the, as you use more, you pay a higher unit rate.
Right. Okay. Yes, per unit is higher.
Right.
Yes. So the allocation factors for water, well, let me say electric first. Electric, we have metering at least for commercial and larger, small commercial and up, that we can measure not only the kilowatt hours but also the demand of the customer, so that we can allocate based on the coincidental demand and the non-coincidental demand. Now, what that means is each year our system peaks. We have historic peaks of how much electricity is required at a given hour of the year. And then, so how much does a customer class impact that versus the other customer classes? And so that is related to the production side. The coincidental peak is related to the production side. The non-coincidental peak is an individual customer can have a higher demand at any hour of the day. Maybe it's even night, depending on the kind of operation. But that affects the distribution system. How large the transformer has to be, ultimately how large the substation feeding it has to be. So there are costs associated with that that can be allocated also. On the water side, we don't have that kind of metering sophistication, but water is a little different because we can store water. Electricity you can't store.
You can store electricity.
Well,
in a battery.
You can, but for the level we're talking about, it's not commercially available yet. But it's true, you can store it.
Jim, your demand customer, is that based on customer class or based on kilowatt demand? What triggers it?
Well, right now, it is based on the kW level, and 25 is the point at which it starts. And then the industrial class is at 750. The utilities are starting to actually explore demand for residential because it is a more equitable way of allocating costs, because it is what you are demanding of the system. We aren't able to do that yet until our metering is changed to the point where we have that information. So, but it's something I think we should explore in the future. So for water, we look really at the seasonal variation of the customer class. What are they doing in the non-summer period? What are they doing in the summer period as a customer class? So it's a similar kind of allocation. It's just not as it's a little bit more general. So for water,
can I ask a quick question, please?
Sure.
Sure. You mentioned the customer classes. I've got a couple of questions about that. One is, do you have any sort of trigger for a review process of how those classes are constructed? And then my other question is do you use the same classification system across utilities?
The answer to the second question is no. We do not necessarily use the same classification. We have only been a combined utilities for less than a year. I don't know if at some point in the future we will decide that's a good idea or not, but at this point the answer is no. We do review customers This software implementation has been a major review. We've been working on this for over a year. We have looked at a lot of the different customers of the different utilities, trying to make sure that everybody was in the proper class. For commercial electric and for the water customers, the commercial water customers, we do review them annually and change them based on the specifications in the ordinance. For instance, a small general service customer in electric, if they exceed 25 kilowatts, or a demand of 25 in the summer, then they're moved into the large general service category. There are often a fairly large number of those that do change on an annual basis. And then there are also several that move back from the large general service back to the small general service, just depending on their activity. So if a customer had barely been over, they had made some major energy efficiency upgrades, maybe a new HVAC system, then perhaps their demand would not be as high the following year and would move back down. Now, we have an optional rate that customers can choose if they want, and it can be advantageous to the small customer that is not a demand customer to choose to be a demand customer, but they have to have a higher load factor, which I'll explain a little bit later. But there is opportunities for that.
Jim?
Sure.
Why is the rate for water cheaper? Is there more water you use?
It's not. It's
CCF.
It's the class of customer. Once again, they move into a different class of customer. And the concept, and I'll talk about it in a little bit, about load factor, and it really works the same on water. It is the analysis of the class of customers. All the customers using that amount of water are fairly consistent in their usage, and they don't fluctuate. So it's that difference between the summer and the non-summer that I mentioned. They don't change very much over the year. And so they're using it at the same level all the time, and it's because they're more consistent, the revenues and costs are more in balance, and so we are only charging them what they are supposed to be charged based on that analysis.
Which is less per gallon than normal customers.
Pardon?
Less per gallon? 260
is. It is less per CCF, yes. And when you get to larger users,
is that treated? Is that treated as a variable cost?
Well, there is variable cost in there. I mean, it's the total cost of that customer class.
Okay. And the other thing, does this? Can you make it a generalization that this follows industry standards?
Well, all of these follow industry standards. I mean, the FERC reporting, NARUC reporting, cost of service analysis, all of those are industry standards for both electric and water utilities.
And then I guess do you find that when you do a cost of service study that cost of service study provider is doing is making these, is able to ascertain the all system costs that are associated with a particular class.
Right.
And then from there then to develop the rate methodology, right?
Right. Now, one thing, let me explain the water rates real quick, and part of that is true and part of it's not in the summertime. We focused on summer both in water and electric because they drive our system requirements. That's when the majority of our electricity is used. That's when the majority of the water is used, is in the summertime. And so because of that, we have to have the larger storage facilities for water, the larger treatment facilities, and the same thing's true on the electric side. Electric, we have a little bit more flexibility in the sense that we don't have to have the generation. We can buy the capacity and the energy from the market, whereas you can't do that with water. Let me explain the water rates real quick. And all water and irrigation customers pay the same amount for the base charge, and that is determined by the size of the meter that they have. It is the same for all classes of customers. There is a difference for outside the city, and there is a difference. We took over a couple of water districts north of town, and part of that agreement, we don't charge as much for the people outside the city in that area as we do for people in other parts of outside the city. But everybody, regardless of the class, pays the same base charge based on the meter size. They also pay the same fire flow based on meter size. Now, the commodity charge is different based on the customer class. And it is true, residential pays the most if on a strictly per CCF basis for the non-summer period. In the summertime, the residential customers, the first two CCF, they pay at the lower rate. Everything above that is at the summer higher rate, which is 391, I believe, is what the current rate is. But
279 for lower rate?
It might be. I'd have to. We're in the process of. Well, actually, I do have that with me, I think. No, I don't actually. The commercial and master meter customers and irrigation customers, the commercial and the master meter customers pay that higher rate starting at 70% of what their non-summer usage was. Irrigation customers pay that amount, the higher rate, starting at zero. So they pay the higher rate for all water usage at that level.
As a point of clarification, if it's metered, if the irrigation is metered.
Well, hopefully it is, yeah. Well, right, if it has a separate meter.
And irrigation is equivalent to lawn sprinkling. And
Right. Yeah. Now, for commercial customers, almost all of it is because they don't have to pay the sewer charge if they have an irrigation meter because obviously it's not running down in the sewer. So typically, a sewer customer will have a lawn irrigation meter separately. Residential is not necessary because their sewer charge is based on their winter average, and so it's not based on their actual consumption.
And so that summertime consumption, they pay the residential rate through their usage.
Right, they pay the higher summer rate. Yeah. Everybody, if you get into the higher classification in the summertime, everybody pays the same higher rate. So the reality is they pay a lot more. You know, they're 260 or whatever it was. They go to the 391s, you know, so they suddenly pay quite a bit more. And then when you collect all of those revenues, including whatever that additional consumption is, above 70% of whatever their winter usage was, and compare it to the cost to serve them, they still are getting that lower rate in the other months. And we do that in electric too. For instance, in residential, we have electric heating customers. We charge them less in the non-summer months than we do in the summer months per kilowatt hour above a certain level. In order to balance out the total cost of service, we don't want to give a discount in the summertime, but we will give a discount in the other months of the year. So because, once again, we want to send that price signal that in the summer, if you're going to use it, you're going to pay more for it.
Okay, so given your experience, and it's an inverted, we'll call it an inverted rate schedule, and so in your opinion, is that cause a behavior change in usage to use less?
Well, it It depends. I think it probably caused more of a behavior change on the water side than it does on the electric side. People will certainly complain when they get their bills on the electric side, but they're still going to turn their air conditioning on. The studies I've seen, it takes about a 10% rate change to cause much of a behavioral change. Now, we have, because we have a four-tier structure in the summertime, going from a little over 7 cents to around 15 cents on the highest, we have a pretty steep inverted structure. So hopefully people are looking at that and realizing that, yes, I need to make my house more efficient. We do get fairly consistent participation in our programs to help people be more efficient. So I think it is, and you usually get more response after a weather event, I guess, hot summer month or a cold winter month. It seems that the number of people requesting either audits or loans or rebates increase after those things.
Would it be fair to say on the water side that the behavior would change after they get their first summer water bill?
Well, I would think that after June,
that the temperature stays the same.
You know, we've had this in place since 1990, so there's been quite a bit of time for people to get it. Plus, technology has been changing significantly over the years. But you still see people watering when it's raining. So I don't...
Oh, I can attest to that.
So I don't know, how... everybody has a different pain point of when you do change your behavior.
Yeah.
So some people, it may not happen.
That's assuming you get a bill.
Well,
if you're mashing meter, you don't get a bill.
Somebody gets a bill.
Well, not the person consuming water or electricity.
Well, the person paying for operations gets it, so
yes.
they probably have the same thing.
But they're not using the electricity or the water.
Well, there's stuff they can do, though. They can put in high-efficiency shower heads and everything else that make it. And particularly students aren't very cognizant of usage, regardless of how they're metered. But, so that's the water side. Now, just to let you know, we used to do residential the same way as commercial, but a number of years ago, and I can't remember how long it's been, snowbirds that had gone south for the winter came back and complained to city council, and so we changed residential. We used to base it on their winter usage because and then anything above that was charged more. But the city council at that time decided that we needed to set a level above which the higher rate went into place, and so we don't do that anymore, basing it on the actual usage of each customer.
Okay, Jim, so I can see that given 48,000 customers, plus or minus, and the complexity of what you explained there, does that drive the necessity for the cost of service study where you get an independent professional industry?
Well, we do it. We don't do it every time we do a cost of service study. My staff are capable of doing it. We do it every few years just to make sure that, we have an outside look at it. We're close. Electric will be over 50,000 probably in the coming year, and water we're at over 49 now. So, in a couple of years we'll be over 50 on both of them.
But it seemed to that when you have $135 million enterprise, that and all those costs and so on to associate in the way that the methodology you've outlined there, that it would take an expert or someone that does that every day for a living to
Well, you know, we have good staff, and certainly I don't mind having an outside person check it every once in a while, but I don't think it's necessary every time we update our cost of service.
And also, would you see that the cost of service study is different than making a rate change?
Of course, yeah. It's just a part of the consideration of the rate. If we had a truly cost of service based rate, we'd have a flat rate.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a block, an inverted block. So on the electric side, residential pays a base charge and energy charge, just like the small general service does the same. Now the difference on the small general service side is that there are customers that have three-phase service, and so their base charge, the three-phase service charge, is a little bit higher. Large general service, they pay a base charge, an energy charge, and a demand charge, and so does industrial, base charge, energy charge, and demand charge. So demand and energy. Demand, if you had a 1,000-watt bulb and you turned it on, you are demanding 1 kW of energy at that time that you turn it on. You have to leave it on for an hour, and then you have a kWh. That's the energy usage. So the difference is demand is, you know, we're turning stuff on all the time, on and off all the time during the day. And energy is the accumulation of those demands over the time period. So we look at, especially on our demand rates, are structured such that it encourages a higher load factor. And a load factor is the ratio of the energy used to the demand and time period. So there's 720 hours in a 30-day month. If you turned 1,000 of those 1,000-watt bulbs on, you'd be using a megawatt or kilowatt. Let's see, a megawatt. And but if you left them on for the entire 720 hours, you would be using 720,000 kilowatt hours of energy. People don't do that, right? You've got lights on. Well, if you have lights on at night and leave them on all night, maybe you use them 12 hours a day. So maybe somebody would have a 50% load factor. But that's, you know, when we have, especially industrial customers that run three shifts, or even a smaller customer that is like a gas station or something that's open 24 hours, they're going to have a high load factor. Their demand, the demand they put on the system, and the amount of energy they use is matched, per se. Our system load factor is about 50%. So we have 50% of our resources that we don't use, essentially, except for 1 hour a year, maybe. So the way our structure is, in those demand customers, we have a high demand charge and a low energy charge. And the higher the load factor, the cheaper the per kilowatt hour is when you add all the costs to it. So this is just an example. An industrial customer with a demand of 1,500 kWs over a month with a 70% load factor would only pay 8.8 cents. Now, they've used a lot more kilowatt hours, but their average cost is only 8.86 cents, whereas a 40% load factor customer would be almost 12 cents per kilowatt hour. And then the same thing on the large general service. It comes out fairly close to a similar cost. Residential customers probably are in the 20 to 25% load factor. So you can imagine that if we were doing the demand, it might, depending on when the demand charge was in place, it might cost quite a bit more per kilowatt hour. The base charge. The base charge, the purpose of the base charge is to recover the cost associated with the customer. It doesn't matter how much energy you use. It is just the fact that you have service available. You're connected to the system, be it water or electric. So, the actual service that to your house, from the meter to, from the transformer to the meter base, which is typically on your house for electric, from the main to the, from the meter service to the main to the meter service, wherever that is, on the water side. Also, the meter reading, the billing, all of the, the customer service people and software related to just putting the bill out, all of those costs are part of what goes into the base charge.
And so would we classify all three of those as fixed costs?
They are fixed, but certainly
they don't change with volume.
Well, they do change with volume at some point, because not with the volume of usage, no. But as you get more customers, they do change.
Is any portion of the base charge you would pay for general operation and maintenance costs?
Typically, there's a very small amount, but not much.
How much?
I'd have to look back in to see what that is. It's not much.
How much base charge do you collect for water and electric?
Water is substantially less than electric at this point, but when we had the last cost of service, one of the recommendations was to increase that, and we are doing that. We hadn't done it because we haven't had a water rate change in the last couple of years, but that's the only change that we're proposing for residential customers this year for FY17. Electric is $15.60, I believe, and we're in a pretty good place on the electric side. Water, we're going to have a couple of rate changes to get it up to a level where it kind of matches what the cost of service is.
You don't have any idea what revenue each one of those charges captures?
I'm sorry?
You don't have any idea how much revenue each one of those charges capture?
How much revenue?
Yes.
We don't capture that information in our billing system. We do, when we design rates, we pull all the information out of the computer system and we run what-if scenarios. We recalculate everybody's bill with the assumption and then determine what the impact of rate changes are. So I estimate that the changes that I'm proposing will give us a 2% rate increase or revenue increase next year just by changing the base charge. Now, do I know that's going to happen? No. Because people come and go. Some people don't pay their bill. But this is what it should be if you, just based on the number of customers and the history we have and some projection of the future.
Do you deposit your base charge in your customer charge in separate accounts?
No.
Was 2012 your last cost of service study?
It was done. Water.
The UFS?
Yeah. Water was, I think it was 12. Was it 12, Tad? Do you remember?
That sounds right. Year,
but we haven't, when it was finished, it was probably late in the year, we haven't done rate increases in a couple of years. There was so we didn't implement any of the recommendations in that, because we didn't need to at that time.
This said on the distribution rates consists of two components, the customer charge to recover the cost of meter reading, billing, customer service, and a portion of maintenance operation of the distribution system.
Right. There is a small part of maintenance of the distribution system.
also have.
The concept is what size system would you need to deliver 1 kilowatt hour of electricity or 1 CCF of water? And so it's not what is the normal usage. So that's the concept of how much of the maintenance is required of from the base charge. It's a minimal amount.
But you know how much?
I can probably find out. I mean, a rough percentage of what the total transmission distribution system costs are.
Yeah.
And this is not related. This got me thinking about it. Let's see. For those that require three-phase power, how do you pull that off the distribution system? Or because most of it's single-phase, so when you have a three-phase customer, what do? You got to go all the way back to where the last three-phase line was and move it forward? And
well, we have a lot of three-phase.
But there's a good part of the internal distribution system that is three-phase, and so that's
right.
Makes it easier for the customer to pull the three-phase off. Because I got to think about that. If you're,
there are some feeders that are
you're out there. And
you have a short generator, three-phase.
Okay, go on.
A lot of the system is mixed use, so
yeah,
got a lot of three-phase out there.
We were talking about meters a little bit last week, but right now you've got meters that are red, but you don't have AMI meters. You're not getting information back on.
That's right. We have AMR meters. We do have some.
Are you planning an AMI pilot? Or
yes. We have a capital project. It's just one of those as soon as we can get to it kind of things, because we've got a whole lot of other stuff that's a little bit higher priority. But yeah, we do have a pilot project designed to do for AMI. We also have some electric research meters out on a number of customers. We got information last summer and we got some more this summer. But we really do want to move towards an AMI type of system.
And then on the electrical side, there would be a movement to go to what we is referred to as a smart meter.
That's what an AMI system is.
AMI, okay.
Yeah. And we would, part of the issue is because we have both water and electric, the water AMIs are much more expensive, and so it's a pretty substantial investment. So it's a little bit slower. I also wanted to talk a little bit about master meter versus individual meters. The utility, it really doesn't matter because the base charge is related to the customer charge or customer-related cost. You can get more revenue, but you also get more costs, and you also get more problems. One of the benefits of the master meter is the master meter owner is going to pay their bill. That is not true of the individual customers. I can assure you. The other thing for the, so going forward, the utility really doesn't care one way or the other. Whether you make new customers do master meters or allow them to do master meter or require that they do individual meters. The only thing it's going to do is to increase our number of customers that ultimately means all of the infrastructure necessary to serve those customers, including the production of individual bills and having the staff to address all of those additional customers. As far as existing customers, there is no difference between a single house, a business, and a fourplex that has a 5/8 inch meter serving it. There's no difference. They all can use the same amount of water. They're being read by the same meter readers. They are all being billed through the same system. So for individual customers or for existing customers, we wouldn't be able to justify charging additional meter charges for existing customers.
Could you justify if he was comparing a 200-unit apartment building with master meters as opposed to a 200-unit apartment building with individual meters?
No.
Why not?
Because the purpose of the base charge is to cover customer cost, and there is no difference.
Except for a portion of it is going to the operation distribution maintenance system.
And they probably have a bigger meter serving that than the 5/8 inch meter. So it really comes out to the same. There is not a significant difference in that.
I believe there is.
Well, I know you do, and I've talked to you many times over the past 10 years about this, but it's the same answer. I don't have another answer for you.
Let's see, on the, is there situations where they do put the individual meters in?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's up to the developer. Some developers do. But, you know, then they have to put in all of the individual plumbing. I mean, so it's kind of a, you know, their decision. But if you're going to have a 200-unit apartment, you're probably going to have a 3-inch meter. Or so, I mean, you know, a 2- or 3-inch meter. You're not going to have a 5/8 inch meter. So your base charge is going to be a lot higher for that service than the individuals.
And then once it's done, there's no practical way to retrofit it.
No.
The tier class that you have is set by meter size or volume, I guess, it's, which is really almost one.
It's based, you know, once you get into commodity, it's based on the actual usage. It's not the...
the base charge.
What? So, any other questions? I would mention, because it has come out in the public, the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Fiscal Report that the Finance Department does. It in FY15, if you look in there, it says Water and Light has $42 million in some amount in cash equivalents and unrestricted. This is where GASB and FERC depart. GASB requires the finance department to report anything that is not bond funds as unrestricted funds. The reality is, out of that $42 million, half of it has been allocated to capital projects. So while if you add up in our FERC laid out financial statements, the cash and cash equivalent of unrestricted funds for water and electric combined and the enterprise funds for capital projects that are in our restricted area, it does equal $42 million. But it's about half that is already allocated to capital projects. So in case anybody is wondering about the status of the utilities, we do not have excess cash. We are actually substantially below our target minimum level. And that's the one of the reasons we're asking for rate increases next fiscal year.
Back to your base charge. Is it safe to say that electric base charge, you're collecting almost $10 million a year?
If we got close to 50,000 customers, whatever, 15, 60, I mean, the base charges are different depending on the class, but I don't know. I haven't calculated that.
And you're collecting almost $5 million a year for water base charge?
Yeah, over what, 48,000 times 12 times the base charges?
I don't know.
That's $15 million a year.
And then put a plus or minus in front of it.
It can't be $10 million. It can't be $10 million. The electric's twice the water rate, and it's only $750,000 per.
Well, that's probably per month.
That's per month. Okay, so times 12.
Oh, times 12.
Yeah. I think it is close to $10 million. Just my point, it doesn't cost $10 million to send a utility bill.
Yeah.
read meters?
Well, no. We have about 20 people in utility billing to handle our customer. You know, we put out over 60,000 bills a month, and we have close to 20 people just in utility billing. And then there's the cashier side, and there's all of the other related charges associated with that, including the computers. So, yeah, it does. Bill, I can't, you know.
If you well, let's see, though. Excuse me.
If I had the numbers, what it cost, and you support your argument, or I can support mine.
It's in our cost of service
study.
We have done a cost of service study.
And it allocates
multiple
it.
Times. In a
I haven't found where the base charge revenue listed for electric is in there. Or water.
The one of the products of the analysis is the base charge.
Right.
Was that done in your 2012?
Yeah.
Cost of service study.
In the water as well as the electric is more current than
right.
the 2012. Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to know how much it costs the city to read meters and send bills. You get those costs are shared.
Well,
shared by refuse, sewer.
Yes, and all of them pay part of that cost.
Yes. I think you're expecting substantially more than you're saying on sending bills and read meters.
Well, it's not. But.
Trust me.
Why should I do that, Bill?
That's what I'm saying. You should be saying, trust me.
Well, we have had outside consultants.
I think that's
over the last 10 years, two different consultants do these that came with the same answers. So it's not me doing it, Bill.
What's in this one? It says a portion of the maintenance and operation cost of the distribution system is being covered by the base charge.
And there is a small part. Like I said, the concept is what does the system require just to deliver the first unit? It is not the major supply of what's provided.
If I had the numbers, I could.
Did you make it back? Tracy?
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's fine.
Well, let's see.
We're at We're finished up with the presentation. We're just doing questions and answers right now.
Right. Thank you.
Let's see. This is I don't want to oversimplify it, but isn't this a matter creating more understanding of the cost of service study?
Well, sure.
Yeah. That's.
Yes.
Yeah. I know. Even in my review, whether it's water or electric, I start out at ground zero and follow their rationale all the way through, and then double check it to see that each classification aggregates those costs, and then go through the computation of how many is in that class, and divided by that many, and divided by 12, and that's what you get the base charge to be. But it seems to me that the cost allocation is very specific and determinable.
There are a lot of support services beyond just the utility billing division. That is the most visible part of customer cost. But part of the purchasing division, part of the legal division of the city, all of those. Some portion of those costs are allocated to just being a customer. So,
it sounds like the base charge, you're separating the base charge from the consumer charge, except for when you put it in the bank. It all goes together.
That's right.
Why don't you keep it separate?
We don't need to. It is revenue.
You justify.
No, it wouldn't. You don't pay for things out of this revenue that you collect. It is. I mean,
what are you paying for them with?
out of the total revenue of the utility, and then you, the purpose of the cost of service is to look back at history and say, take all of these costs that we had and all of the revenues that we have and allocate them out and see where are you not matching up, and then adjust them accordingly. You aren't on an annual basis saying, I'm going to collect this money and pay for this stuff and only use this money. You don't. It doesn't work like that. And it's not a practical concept to do that.
Is the last cost of services analysis available for viewing for anybody in the group? Is that it?
Well, if you want to try, I got to honestly tell you, it is probably 50 spreadsheets, and I quite honestly do not have time to walk you through it.
There's not a summary report that would be.
Well, there's a published report that has the recommendations for what.
It's very logical. I don't want to brag.
You know, within the constraints of this group, I mean, I know that you've got a lot of passion for some of these issues, but we're still focused on the electric side, just in the downtown area. But rate does come into the play for that, and we're not exploring water. So, other than you shared it with us today and how water's done.
Well, I mean, as far as downtown, most of the customers are commercial. I mean, there are some residential. There are also some three-phase where residential has been put in, but they are still charged the commercial rate because our ordinances say that residential can't be three-phase, so we charge them a commercial
rate. These new developments going in are coming in single-phase?
They are. Well, if they are metered individually, they are
single-phase.
We have also modified, the utility needs to be responsive to technology. And one of the changes that we have in our ordinances is that in residential plan developments, they can be master metered for electric. And the reason is, the technology is changing. So if you have a HVAC system that you want to supply everything for the building, or that you want to have solar that you want to supply to everyone in the building, or there's other technologies that are coming along, then it makes more sense to do that on a building-wide standpoint, or if they have backup generation or, you know, other options like that. That is kind of the direction.
In fact, LEED encourages that. The LEED certification of buildings encourages, especially on-site renewables and efficient ways to deliver services to buildings.
So the reality is that technology is kind of pushing in the direction of more single-meter buildings rather than less.
You didn't cover fuel adjustments or utility market adjustments. Do you have it? An adjustment factor in there for swings in the market and fuel prices.
We have the ability to add a fuel adjustment at any time without going through City Council if the need arises. Typically, we haven't done that since 2008. Typically, the reason we don't do that, it kind of puts the major burden on the high usage customer, which is not necessarily appropriate. So we typically just do rate changes. At that time, our cash flow, because of the, I think it was 2008, there was a dramatic change in energy cost that really required us to recover revenue quickly.
It was the year of the high natural gas prices.
Yeah.
And corresponding to high electric prices.
Right. What was the other question?
No, that was it.
Okay.
Any other questions from the task force before we open up to our visitors today?
I wanted to go back to the electrical to kind of understand better, because this is not my area of expertise. When you were talking about load factor average and essentially the lower percentage load factor average pays more per kilowatt hour, correct? So you were saying residential is likely a 25% load factor.
Right.
And then your numbers were 40%.
My point was that the higher load factor is using our system more efficiently because, you know, it would be wonderful if we were 100% load factor because we would be maximizing the use of our infrastructure. That's not going to happen. So rather than having the customers that are close to that essentially subsidize other customers that are not, we design this purposefully that as you have a better load factor, your average cost per kilowatt hour goes down because we have a high demand and a low energy.
So how does that affect like commercial, what we were talking about with commercial units that are residential?
Well, it doesn't
affect.
Master
meter, then
right.
Do they have a different, how does their load factor?
Actually, they would. I mean, a 200 kW or 200 unit master meter would probably be on the large general service rate, and it would probably have a load factor because all those residential units are not using energy 24/7, and they would pay probably a quite a bit higher per kilowatt hour cost than a typical single residential customer.
But the base charge on a large general service meter is $45.
And that, because it doesn't cost very much, we are moving that number up too, but it doesn't cost very much.
90 cents.
Huh?
90 cents.
90 cents for what?
You're moving it up 90 cents to
right.
$45.90.
Right.
Whereas 200 individual electric meters, the base charge is $3,182. $3,000 compared to $45. It's a big difference.
Right. But we only have one service, not
yes.
200.
But that's multiplied by each service, each water, electric, sewer, power flow.
And if we had all of those, we'd have all the accompanying cost associated with them that we would have to recover for.
So, excuse me, that leads back to my question that I unfortunately got cut off on. Jim, did you answer in terms of are these questions that Bill is asking, are they part of a standard cost of service study? It seems like these are things easily calculated.
These?
Or it's not easily, straightforwardly.
No. It is a standard utility methodology. It is not a simple process, but it is the standard methodology used by utilities across the country.
This is not quite related, but it is, I think it might have some pertinence. Just real briefly, indicate to us the load factors of renewable energy.
Capacity
factors.
Capacity factors.
Yeah, on the production side, it's called capacity factor.
Yes.
Solar is around 17%. Wind on, Greg could speak more to the local, but where we buy wind from, it's in the around 30%.
High wind area.
Higher wind area. Now, you know, the technology is evolving still, and they're claiming higher production levels.
Any other questions? Task force before?
I got a few. And some of these are just piggybacking off of some of the stuff you had in your recommendations, Bill, but I just wanted to see your thought process on them. One of the things that has been considered by Water and Light Advisory Board, and we've talked about a little bit, was the connection fees. Bill has proposed the recommendation that we support establishing an electric connection fee. how do you see that fitting into the revenue? I know it seems to make sense, you know, to expand the capital, but if it's all going into the same pot, and we're not reducing the rates any, we're just getting more money. Like, how is that addressed in the cost of service?
We have connection fees on the water side.
Yes.
And traditionally, electric hasn't done it just because the benefit of having additional customers allowed you to recover the cost anyway. We actually had a consultant look at connection fee and got a report back on it with a methodology. I think the Water and Light Board is actually discussing that tomorrow or some.
That connection fee was done months ago, and it could have been a year ago. And there's
I had a report that was in 2015.
Yeah,
and it's the administrative quagmire approval process has not elevated itself to being functional yet, and that we're going to bring it up again tomorrow to at the meeting to elevate its status.
And the
because it should have been done months and months and months ago.
First question, and I think that's going to be discussed tomorrow. Is it a Hancock issue? As a government entity, you always have to be cognizant of whether you're doing something that violates the Hancock Amendment. So when is it a tax rather than a fee? And so I think that's the first question that they're going to be talking about.
And we've already asked that question.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, obviously you have to consider that when you're thinking about it, but that's kind of beside the point what the task force would be considering, because it would be like, do you see value? Do we need to be doing this? And then we recommend that we try to take it to the voters. I'm not trying to get into whether we should or shouldn't take it to the voters.
No, I'm not either.
Yeah. Well, let me get back to your other point. It would be a very unstable revenue source because...
And that's kind of where I was getting at. Yeah, like,
I mean, it would certainly be. I mean, once again, all the revenues go into the electric or the water, depending on which it is. Probably 95% of our revenues on the electric side are from ratepayers. The other, we participate in the energy market. We have transmission service that we're paid for through the energy market. We have investment interest, that comes back. But all of those sources are not the best reliable things that you can have. So we tend to budget very conservatively as those for revenue streams. Sometimes we do better, sometimes we don't do as well as we think we're going to. The same would be true of an electric connection fee. Water, it's a few hundred thousand dollars a year, I think, depending on the year, depending on how much construction is going on. So is it a big revenue stream? No, and this wouldn't be either. But it would offset something going forward.
Would you think, would it be to you valuable? You've done some studies because you've got something on the books that is supposed to be being looked at. But is this something that would be incorporated into the cost of service study, whether by your staff or by the separate consultant, to see how much value, what kind of revenue we would generate? And does the capital improvements that the electric utility need to do, like, does it actually need this connection fee? We've got the rates and the bonds, and we request it when we need it.
A portion of the development is paid for by ratepayers. I mean, so because now the new development is a ratepayer as well.
And that's where I would be getting at.
So, new development, should they be paying connection to help defray some of those development costs? Which for the utility.
Which, if the rates are payers are paying for it now, then maybe to me it would seem like you would the corresponding reduction in
agreed.
Rates.
Okay. Either reduction in rates or keep them growing.
It's not a, I'd say, Cody, it's not of a, compared to $135 million.
It's not a huge number. I mean, you know.
Okay, and really another way to look at it, Cody, is that what it does, in a sense, if you follow it through, it would forego, if I get this right, it would forego the next time you'd have to have a rate adjustment,
right? Right.
It would defray your future. Defer your cost avoidance.
It would defer it
future rate increase.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, and then you would.
But I can assure you we would be very cautious in the sense of how stable is that going to be.
So I'll, unless somebody else has connection fee questions, I'll go on to my next question. So I brought this up with Brian, and I don't necessarily have a strong opinion either way. I'm just curious, do you see any benefit, like from your perspective, on these net zero, whether or not they're actually net zero, but is there any savings to the utility that would justify a discount?
No, there's actually the opposite. It's a cost that's spread to other customers. We need to address that issue because what happens is the solar production is occurring, the sun goes down, their usage goes up to be what everybody else is and goes on from that. And as you know, I mentioned the solar capacity factor, you know, that is around 17%. So whatever their rated capacity is, it's only producing about 17% of that. And because it's night, it's cloudy, it's, you know, all of the other things. It's a big issue in the country of, you know, because initially utilities kind of ignored it, which I think we did too. Mm-hmm. Now you've got a certain number of people that have done this. We need to be, the utility should be essentially agnostic to solar. It should be such that other customers are not subsidizing them and they're getting the correct benefit. Now, because we only, you know, Austin is sometimes thrown around. Austin has a totally different structure than we do. You can't just take one utility's method and stick it into our situation. They meter the panel, and they meter the house separately, and then they run them both through a structure. We do not meter the panel and the house. We meter the difference between it. So, what is the house using from our system? What is the panel pushing back to our system? What the panel is providing to the house, we don't know. But so the customer is benefiting from not having to pay for that at all, right? That's their investment. They get to do that. The Ameren would only pay the customers about 3 cents. We pay them a minimum over 7 cents. We shouldn't be doing that, in my opinion. and if we are going to ultimately send the right price signals to everyone, we need to move in that direction.
Solar peak is not coincident with load peak.
No, our peak
is much later in the afternoon. Solar peak is noon or a little after.
Right. Our peak typically occurs in the 5 to 7 range in the evening. At that point, solar is rapidly decreasing, and that's in the good months of the summer. In the winter, when our peaks occur, the sun's not up because our peak typically occurs before sunrise.
So does that show then that the need for technological advances to store energy?
It does. But once again, I mean, yeah, if customers would store energy and get through that, I mean, I went to a demand conference, a residential demand conference in June, I think, in Phoenix, and the Arizona Public Service has something like 30,000 customers on a residential demand rate, and they are targeted in a block of time.
of what the demand is. So, you know, it is a better way of saying what is each customer having an effect on the system. But it'll be a while before we
can do that. Does it go to that as we fully implement smart meters, then does that change? That changes the ballgame, doesn't it? Because of the incremental data?
Well, it does if we change the rate structures.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's what.
Right.
I think that would be the logical thing that would happen because you got more finite data in a smaller increment of time. And then.
Right.
Bill also brings up the very contentious, I believe, the depreciation issue. How would you think it should be addressed? Should we address it? Should we not address it? I mean, you probably want it to go away, but
it's not an issue. I mean, what the charter says, if you read the charter,
I read through it. Now I'm not. I don't. Just because I read it doesn't mean I fully understand it.
You know, that was written in 1949 or something. Mm-hmm. There's a statement in there about engineering and accounting standards that basically allows our looks forward and says, you know, this is what we know now, but things can change. So do what the engineering and accounting standards tell you to do in the future. That's what that clause says, and that's what the city does. You can't set aside money for the depreciated value of something. You buy something for $1 million today, it's depreciated over 30 years, you're not going to rebuild it for $1 million. It's going to probably cost three times as much. So what we do budget for depreciation. It is not a cash expense on an annual basis. It is a line item in our budget. And from a financial management standpoint, that number, when you look at interest and principal cost on an annual basis on bonds, plus the amount of enterprise funds reinvested in the capital projects, should be somewhere close to that depreciation number. And what that says is that you are reinvesting in your system at least that amount. Now, that's going to fluctuate. Some years we invest a lot more. Sometimes we might invest a little bit less. But in general, that would be our goal, to at least invest that amount on an annual basis. And the the principal and the interest is your bonds that you have, that voters have approved and you have put into your system, and then the additional cost of the of whatever you're investing directly that year into capital projects.
Yeah. So,
go ahead.
So, you being very familiar with the ordinance, and a lot of people aren't, and they're bringing up these wordings and, you know, out of context, it sounds right. Like, and I'm not disagreeing with the way we do it at all. It sounds like, I mean, who am I to say we're doing it wrong? But is it confusing, the language that's in there now? Would it be helpful if there was new language that we wouldn't have to
rehash this? The charter can only be changed through an election. So,
is it not worth going to change it?
Okay. May I express my opinion?
You can express your opinion, yes.
For what it's worth, I've been following this for 26 years. And I've had professional experience in reviewing accounting systems and audits and depreciation. The depreciation is not a magic number. How is depreciation determined? Well, depreciation is determined. We have an asset book, and all the assets go on the book, and then they're assigned a depreciable value based upon some industry standard. And so you do that every year. You multiply it across, you add it down. That's how much depreciation is. Then the depreciation fund is account number, in the water is account number 877000. As far as I'm concerned, that's a depreciation fund. And it's expensed every year. And then you have to have some knowledge of how an income and expense statement works with the balance sheet. As if you depreciate it, you don't pay it to anybody. It's a non-expense item. If you meet budget, what happens? It'll flow all the way down to the bottom, right? Because you haven't paid it to anybody. But you, and it's in the rate, so it flows all the way to the bottom. And it comes out this way and goes up to the balance sheet in what he was referring to as the current assets. And then it's allocated based upon the CIP budget as to putting it into a restricted category. Now, there are, I'm going to give you the full story. Okay, the answer to this, one answer.
I don't have any problem with the way we do our billing.
I don't either, I think we can get at now. a reasonable answer that everybody could live with. Number one, that is the depreciation fund. Right there. It exists. It's real. It's expensed every year. I've seen it expensed for the last 26 years. The other thing that could happen is that in the balance sheet, we could essentially, where it says non-restricted assets, in parentheses, we could put the words depreciation fund, because that's where it's derived from, depreciation, from that account. Okay. See how that would work? Okay, it's identifiable. Everybody would see it. The another alternative is, since if it is contentious, then I think the council should solicit the legal department to have the city's bond council review all those, that ordinance, which was created in 1948, and go through a chronological analysis and have them render opinion whether or not we're in compliance. Another alternative would be that to expand the scope of the city's annual audit to have a scope of service that will direct an independent audit of how we're doing it and render their opinion through a licensed certified public accountant.
Well, I'm not sure that's not already part of the annual audit.
To help everybody, the ones that are
that's
not
all
comfortable.
I'm trying to do.
Right. I think you're right, Cody. It's the ones that are not comfortable with it. Well, let's get an independent review, and it's not a big deal. I've worked with bond counsel many, many times for them to have them examine some funding accounts that come out of the bond ordinance that you need somebody that they're the expert. They do this, and it's easily determinable by them to make that determination. So I think at the end of the day, the real we don't want to be in violation of the charter. But I think there's sufficient evidence that can be pinpointed that demonstrates that we're not. And also that there's not any financial maneuvering by the utility department to take these funds and secretly put them off. That's nonsense. And because the crux of it is that the city receives a city audit every year, and an auditor makes their money by revealing the crooks. Okay, and we've had a certified audit, and they get in there and they dig into the details, and that's their
Yeah, I'm not trying to audit anything.
I think, in summary, Cody, we
addresses why this is so contentious. It seems like there's something that could be done to.
I do too.
Clarify.
I think there can be something done that will.
The revenue had two parts.
Pardon?
The revenue had two parts. Either fix it or clarify.
Yeah, and I think the. Sometimes I think the best clarification is if it's done independently. You got save the city, and then you have those that are not agreeing. Well, we've got to have an independent review so that the city and the others, they'll come together to.
So I'm just going back to Bill's recommendation. I would like to kind of word the recommendation more to that effect, as opposed to telling city council they need to change the ordinance or they need to start changing the way they bill.
That's the way I agree.
As opposed to the way it's written now, maybe try to say, maybe we could look at this from a third party to give, you know, say, hey, you know,
this just review to ensure that we're in compliance with the charter.
Maybe something like that.
Right. Yeah. Depreciation is alive and well in the water enterprise and the electric enterprise. It's alive and well, and it's well grounded. And then the other thing is how do you think that we get the money to fund the CIP? See, the CIP is not an expense. It's a capitalized category, and it's only funded by net revenues that come out of the income and expense statement. and we've been so the way we've done it over all these years, that's why we've been able to reinvest in the system. You know, where does that money come from? Well, you depreciate it, and then if you have a good year, people, you know, have high usage, and then that you didn't budget, then that flows to the bottom line, that flows over to the balance sheet, and that flows to the restricted or non-restricted cash.
I'm following.
But I agree with you. I think that's kind of the slant we ought to take.
Is there any further questions for the task force? You got one more,
and this is the last one. And this is a broad question, but Jim, would you suggest any areas that could be improved that you'd like to see the task force address? Is there any particular areas that you think aren't or that could function better, or that you would like more information about, or you see that we could be doing better?
On water and electric?
On electric.
Can I please add just a joiner to that question? And that would be, Jim, could you talk a little bit about any long-range plans you have as a department to implement in the next few years?
Well, I mean, we maintain a 10-year capital plan that we update every year. We also have a 10-year financial plan in terms of, you know, when do we think we'll need a bond issue? When do we think we will need rate changes? I mean, all of this, of course, is speculation based on the growth rates we think we'll see, the cost increases we think we'll see, but we adjust those every year as we go forward. And, you know, capital projects, you know, we have a good methodology to review the needs of the utilities in sense of, you know, like right now we're going through a pole inventory in electric. So people are going around, you know, basically checking every pole to see the condition of them, exactly what other utilities are on them, making sure they are tagged correctly and that stuff. And they're finding some issues and they are fixing them. We have regular scheduled infrared. We have a staff member, and his primary responsibility is using infrared camera to shoot our substations, big transformers, breakers, other parts of the system that is subject to failure, to make sure that we are proactive in our system. We have water modeling software that we update, maintain records of all, you know, breaks, so that we, if we see problem areas, we can reallocate resources to those areas to maybe push those forward.
once.
Okay. I was specifically thinking about in the billing finance sort of area.
You know, we have just, as of yesterday, implemented a new billing system, and we are working through the, you know, every software has some bumps, and we're working through those. I think you will, I think customers will like the product because it will provide you with a lot more information. We are looking at some additional customer education software that will actually allow you to see more information. I don't know of anything offhand that we require that we're not looking at. We maintain, as far as technology is concerned, we try to keep abreast of how technology is evolving. You know, the battery storage issue, that is not commercially viable yet, but we are monitoring that. So,
car charging stations.
You know, there are some car charging stations in town. We did buy an electric car to kind of get a taste of what it does and what it requires. The utility has not, we are not currently discussing putting those out as a utility. A lot of times businesses are doing that themselves to encourage customers, you know, come to our store, we've got a spot where you can park and plug in, and while you're shopping, you're recharging your car. So a lot of times those kinds of things are going to be marketplace based that is going to address those issues. So we watch them, but that doesn't necessarily mean we do anything about them, depending on what it is.
I think one of the things you mentioned at the beginning of your presentation is very important, that there be some consistency between utilities for customer classification. Like a residential customer ought to be the same for water, electric, sewer, refuse. And you got to realize that you really got two customers. You got the customer paying the bill as meter. You got the customer a lot of times is using products different than the customer paying the bill. The customer is using the products, also your customer. And I like to see customer classifications based on the use of the facility rather than the customer classification.
Well, we'll be looking at that. It is not always necessarily possible.
Different from zoning.
Well, I know that.
A lot of it's long term.
Yeah. And, you know, when you get into, you know, things like the fraternities and sororities, the retirement homes, the, you know, you get into that middle ground that it certainly would make it easier on staff a lot of times if everybody agreed on what a particular customer is. But that's not going to happen overnight, I can assure you.
You know, most of your cost of service studies recommend that you don't one classification customer doesn't subsidize another.
And they don't.
Well, it's good, but they do. If they're not classified properly, they are.
We classify based on the service at this time.
Sometimes
and that is the service on electric is, you know, when we have them classified as commercial, small general service, large general service, for instance, sororities and fraternities are classified as large general service or small general service. That is how the costs are allocated and classified and is evaluated for those kinds of customers. Now,
if you get a master metered building, it's master metered, 200 unit apartment building, master meter is classified as commercial. But individually metered, same building, different type of meter is classified as residential. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't seem to me like to be consistent.
It is, because you've only installed one service to that building.
Well, I'm talking about the use of the building. And the use of the building is residential, regardless of how it's metered.
Well, but the electric use, the electric infrastructure necessary is different.
That's what we ought to straighten out.
I think you brought something earlier that we have to talk through, because I think the types of buildings going out there are changing, and you're seeing more centralized services, like the heating and cooling system, maybe even solar system or renewable energy generation. It's not going to fit your model of having a residential meter. It's going to fit a different type of model,
right,
that we haven't even talked about yet. And I do think, though, that the fact that the utilities have merged, bringing water and sewer into electric, and sewer and stormwater into water and electric, does identify an opportunity to relook at those rate classes and make sure they're at least reasonably consistent and not conflicting with each other.
Yes, I agree.
And, you know, when I started working for the utility, there was no industrial class of customer. That's how long ago it was. So, and the reason we have an industrial class is because it doesn't make sense to put a whole bunch of small customers in with a Kraft Foods or 3M that have
this hospital center.
Boone Hospital Center, any of those, there is a different level of service usage patterns that you really should look at differently, separately, to make sure that you are collecting the cost associated with that, and to make sure they are not subsidizing the other customers. We also didn't charge demand until 100 kW. We moved that down to 50, and then we moved it down to 25 a number of years ago. Now, that moved more customers into these different classes. So we had a relatively low range, a limited range when I started with the utility that has changed over time. The utility needs to be flexible to address customer needs to some extent, as long as it is not a detriment to other customers. And we can do that by evaluating the cost to serve that class of customer. And as technology changes, that is going to be more true, and probably you're going to see more of that kind of whole building heating system. We had a presentation a few years ago from a district heat pump concept, where it would have been multiple buildings fed by a heat pump system. You know, the university has a steam system. The potential as technology changes is that somebody will come in and say, I'm going to put in a heat and power system that produces electricity and produces heat that can be used for steam for whatever purposes. So there has to be some flexibility going forward, and realizing that technology is going to change.
Tracy, it's about 2020 till we have several guests. I think, should we have a chance to ask questions, or there's still?
I have a couple real quick bullet
points. John's got a couple more before we go to that.
Number one is that we have not talked about the bond rating, and as to how it's an output from all of this, that our bond rating is a reflection of that, and we haven't even talked about that as to what. When you look at this, as to what factors stand out as to influencing the bond rating, and that you have to be cognizant of that as you go through this business enterprise. In the water and light department, the bonds are issued as combined water electric revenue bonds, and we pledge the net revenues of both the systems, but they're run as separate enterprises, and so they contribute based upon their size. But it's not always a common thought with the citizens that those are combined water electric bonds. And And anyway, the bond, my only point is the bond reading is a reflection or comes out about all of this. Then the other thing is the in recent years, we have adopted a cash reserve policy. We have very distinct, it's an ordinance, and we go through, that becomes a financial measure and has to be looked at. And very briefly, the cash reserve policy, think of it as in terms of the real emergency fund that given a, say, a real storm event as to that we could possibly live through and still be financially sound. Okay, and then this is not related to it, but it's something that that the general citizen does not, I don't think, recognizes, is that on the water side is that the city has an ISO, Insurance Service Organization, rating of 2. And so what does that mean for the citizens and the commercial users and everything? What that means for them is reduced insurance premiums. They're seeing that on the side. They're paying for the water, but they, by having an ISO rating of 2, they get the benefit through their insurance determination and get reduced insurance premiums, which in the outer space theory, I think there ought to be more analysis to equate that. But anyway, okay. And then, in summary, if you really have an appetite for this, that you need to dive into the CAFR, the Consolidated Annual Financial Report of the City, in the section that has to do with sewer utility and the section that has to do with water and light. It's very revealing. It's a 10-year span of time all this information reveals to you, and you get a real good sense of what's going on, what's happened, and where we stand. But okay.
You can invite them to the Water and Light Board meeting tomorrow morning, too.
That's right, because that's I've made sure that they're going to...
Are we good for some first, right? Public comment?
Cody,
questions?
Check the minutes of the meeting. Yeah.
So it's 8:45, right? And right. Jim, I don't know if you have any response to the issues John brought up. I'm glad to give you a couple minutes for that. But to give the public participants a chance to ask their questions, I'm not sure how many folks are there, but the goal is to... adjourn at 9. So please, you know, give yourself 2 or 3 minutes to ask your question, give the person you're asking it to a chance to respond along those lines, and we should be able to get everybody's questions in. Please monitor yourself, but we'll let you know if you get past the three or so minute mark.
We can start. Well, there's 3 visitors here today, Tracy, so you want to start in the back?
Right.
You might speak up so Tracy can hear you as well.
Hi, Tracy. It's Maria. Or Paula.
Hi, Maria.
I'm actually looking for just two pieces of information, details, filling in you said. Your cash equivalent, you made mention of a target minimum level, but you didn't say what it was. Would you care to share that?
Sure. The annual, it changes, but for 16, it's $29 million for the electric utility. What we think we will only end the year at about $23 million.
Okay. And one other question, and this is regarding the rate. When was the last time we had an electric rate increase?
We had one in June of 2015.
And that was for?
The bond issue, and the first sale.
And
3%.
3%. And now we're asking for 2.
Right.
And they're not, they're...
Thank you.
They have different causes.
I know.
Okay.
I understand all this. But that's needed to be said.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tracy.
Sure. So, but I have a follow-up question to Maria's question, Jim. Is one, is it a regularly published policy as to so that the public can review what that minimum rate is or goal number is per year for the money in, you know, the money in hold, the $29 million. So that people can know what the city's goal is in any given year, as well as the methodology used to calculate that.
It is a
The information is provided to the Water and Light Board and I think to the City Council. I don't know if it is put on the website or not, but the Water and Light minutes are put there, so I would assume it is.
The way it works is that think it of that the fiscal year ends September 30th, okay, and so then the analysis and the computation is made in October or maybe November, depending on the close of the books to the fiscal year, because the data is extracted from that prior year. And then the ordinance is specific as to how the computation is made. And then if you look at the balance sheet, the monthly balance sheet in the Water and Light Department, and when you look in the non-restricted assets, you'll notice that line item and then the inventory, the next line item, are in bold. And that's the threshold that is compared against as to whether we're at a level of adequacy for cash reserves.
Okay.
And
thank you.
Because we wanted to be really easy for the board members to be able to, those numbers are in bold, so you just write in, you just take those two numbers, add them together, and then you go through the computation of the requirement, and then you compare the two. And actually, we do it to the extent that you have a high and they have a low. And then you fit in where the actual year demonstrated and see where you are in that band. And sometimes you might be down at the bottom of the lower part of the band, or sometimes you're, depending on the year, as to being up on the higher side. And these are non-restricted assets, which are independent of the capital CIP projects and any of the bond funds that are not included in it, because that's dedicated to CIP. So does that help out, Jim?
You have a question, Doug?
Thank you very much. You mentioned earlier that there's a cost of service study done for water in 2012. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. When was the last one done for the electric?
It was 14, I think.
If are they available on the city website to look at?
I don't know, actually, but I can get them to you if you give me some contact information.
Can you email the address of that?
Sure.
That'd be fine. You mentioned there's a 10-year capital plan. Sorry, repetition, same kind of question. Is that also out there?
It is an internal document. It is not published because it changes. We don't want people to believe that this is going to be done this year. I mean, we have to have it. We want to make sure we're looking forward and believe these are things we're going to have to spend money on. But over a 10-year period, things change. And so every year we are adjusting that. So that is an internal document that we maintain. We do not publish that. We only publish the coming year information. Well, yeah, that's not true. We do publish in the budget. There is a it is 2 years out are specific, and then there's a grouped of 3 to 5 years, and then there's a beyond 6 year or 6 years and beyond that have a list, but it's not specific for the years that we use in our internal planning. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. John?
Well, I have several things. First of all, I like the way you phrase it. Jim, by the way, thank you. This is quite helpful. It's always quite helpful. Not necessarily complete, but helpful. I really like the fact that you mentioned that a number of utilities are coming under the same umbrella, and that should be the occasion for reviewing a number of things. several of the things you were mentioning, but in particular, this whole concept of base charge. I'm sorry, this is a concept about utilities. It's not just a concept about electric, and some kind of rationalization about what that means and what should be in it across at least those four major utilities. What Jim is talking about is quite different than what was in the Burton report about sanitary sewer. And I'm not sure what was in the solid waste report, but I'm hoping that this kind of stuff will be much more closely looked at. Because just because it's an industry standard in one sense doesn't mean it adequately serves a bunch of other issues. I was particularly interested in the emphasis on the efficiency of the system, the 100% load factor. That's really interesting. But I'm not exactly, and for a certain sense that makes sense, I'm not sure that's the best definition of efficiency for thinking about our systems overall in various ways. With respect to the connection fee, I'm glad you emphasized, well, we could do it, but it's not a very stable source. And in most of your presentation, there was a tremendous amount of emphasis on the stability of being able to see the revenues and this kind of stuff. The point of the system equity connection fee is not about stability. It's about equity. Now, if we're going to need a whole bunch more capacity, a whole bunch more stuff that we would not have needed before, it's about equity, about new development and expanded usage, paying its fair share of that capital cost. But now I understand a lot about if you're all about the stability and so forth, this is a small thing and it doesn't fit. But I'm hoping this group will reemphasize, for our purposes and for the city's purposes, it can't just be about that stability thing. I would be very interested, since the projection for the year end on that cash issue was $29 million. It looks like it's going to come in at $22 million. I'm wondering whether you can bring back to this group and otherwise, so what do you attribute that shortfall to? Something didn't match your projections and so forth. And it may be, actually, I noticed my bills are not as bad. Maybe it was just, actually, it wasn't as cold as or hot as or whatnot at the wrong time.
Actually, I can answer that, John.
Well, actually, don't use up my time right now.
Okay.
Actually, one of the kind of things, and I think Maria may have asked this, I'm very interested in by what standard are you measuring that cash reserve is low? If you could actually bring back to this group a kind of written explanation of how what your goal is and what goes into that. Thank you for trying to go through the audits, but annual financial audits are not about fraud. They're not about that. They're about financial status. And I liked your beginning explanation about depreciation. In 30 minutes, I can explain these relative things. But in many ways, the biggest point is, I'm sorry, this whole business about depreciation is a big, contentious, controversial issue. And frankly, the city for years has just poo-pooed anybody asking a question about it. We need to do
so,
the
John, you're at
to
4 minutes,
to
so can you please wrap up?
I will. I think that was it. We need to do something about that. And I'd be glad to give a 30-minute presentation on depreciation in its various categories. It is an expense, but that doesn't mean it ended up in being a fund and an asset. There's a way to understand that fairly simply. It's just an extrapolation of what you did. Thank you. And thank you, Tracy.
Thank you.
I can quickly answer a couple of those things if you want me to.
I do.
Okay.
Yes.
Regarding the cash position, a few years ago, we had a bond issue to buy the Columbia Energy Center, the natural gas plants north of town, that it actually ended up saving us money because we were paying
capacity charges to Ameren, and we actually ended up saving money. But as part of that, we told the voters that we would not have another bond issue for a few years, and we paid everything out of cash. And at the same time, we had a number of very mild summers. The combination was that we spent a lot of our cash. It takes time to rebuild that, and we are in the process of doing that. So that's why our cash position is down. But it's not something that we have to react to quickly. It's something that we can address over time. As far as how we calculate our cash position, the general fund uses a 20% of expenditures, annual expenditures. What we argued for as a utility, because we are capital intensive, we argued to use that 20% of expenditures plus the amount of money that we were going to take out of enterprise funds for the following year for capital projects. And the combined total would be our cash target. So we look at all of our expenses, including not only our O&M expenses and interest payments, but also the principal on debt, and take 20% of those, that total, and then we add on the future, the next year's funds that we are going to take from enterprise revenue, because essentially that is set aside immediately on day one of the new fiscal year. So that is what our target cash position is.
Thank you. On the record.
Tracy, we have no other guests.
Okay. Well, it's 8:59. So, if do task force members have any closing comments or staff?
They both are shaking their heads no.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much for bearing with me via conference call. And we're adjourned. I look forward to seeing you the week after next.
Safe travels.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye.
That's on 14. 14.
All right. Bye-bye.